Imagine if the next time you were faced with a life-threatening, highly toxic environment, your body just didn't fight back.
Right, like no immune response at all.
Exactly. Instead, you just hit a biological pause button on your own aging, built an invisible suit of plant armor out of wood fibers, and, well, simply waited for the danger to pass.
Which sounds like science fiction, honestly.
It really does. But today, we are looking at an animal that does exactly that. So, welcome to this custom-tailored deep dive. We have a seriously fascinating mission ahead of us today.
We really do.
We are pulling from an incredible master's thesis by Celeste Valdivia from the University of Washington School of Aquatic and Fishery Sciences. And we're also using the transcript of her live thesis defense presentation.
Yeah, and the goal here is to explore how a globally invasive, frankly squishy, marine invertebrate reacts to extreme toxic stress.
Right, and how its bizarre survival mechanisms are completely redefining what we know about cellular biology and regeneration.
It is just a phenomenal piece of research to dig into, primarily because, it forces us to question everything we assume about how an animal should protect itself at a molecular level.
Totally. Now, if you are listening to this and wondering what on earth you could possibly have in common with a squishy blob living on the side of a marina dock, here is the crazy part.
This is my favorite fact about these guys.
Right. This creature is a tunicate, and it is actually the closest living invertebrate relative to vertebrates.
Meaning us?
Yes, meaning us. We share a deep evolutionary ancestor. So the survival mechanisms we are going to talk about today aren't just like alien biology, they actually belong to a distant evolutionary cousin.
Yeah, a very distant cousin, but still on the family tree.
Exactly. So to kick things off, let's introduce the star of our deep dive. The Botrylus schlosseri, also known as the Golden Star Tunicate.
It's quite a majestic name for a sea blob.
It is. And if I had to describe it visually, I'd say it looks like a sci-fi collective. I mean, it is a colony of individual animals, which are called zoots.
Right, zoods.
And they arrange themselves in these beautiful star-shaped systems. They all share an external blood supply, pumping a fluid called hemolymph back and forth.
Yeah, and just to give a quick point of reference for hemolymph, it basically operates as the invertebrate equivalent of blood.
Okay, got it.
So it circulates nutrients and oxygen, and it carries their highly complex immune cells throughout the entire shared system. And the entire colony is encased in this clear, gelatinous outer shell called a tunic.
Hence the name tunicate.
Exactly. What's fascinating here is its unbelievable life cycle. It's a process known as blastogenesis. Yeah.
Blastogenesis.
If the surrounding water is at a comfortable, say, 18 to 20 degrees Celsius, this entire colony regenerates itself every single week.
Wait, so an entirely new body from scratch every 7 days.
Every 7 days.
Wow.
Primary buds literally grow alongside the adult zoods, developing their own organs over the course of just a few days.
That's incredibly fast.
It is. And then comes the final phase, which researchers call stage D or takeover.
Takeover sounds dramatic.
Oh, it is. During this takeover phase, the adult zooids close their siphons. They just stop feeding from the water column entirely. Then they undergo massive, highly coordinated cell death. It's an organized biological dismantling called apoptosis.
Okay, let's unpack this for a second. Apoptosis is basically when a cell programs itself to die, right?
Yes, exactly. The adult bodies systematically break themselves down into raw cellular materials,
Like recycling.
precisely like recycling. Those materials are then reabsorbed by the colony's shared vascular system to feed that new generation of primary buds.
Oh, wow.
And then those buds open their siphons and take over as new adults.
That is wild. And, if you're listening to this and wondering why scientists care so much about a marine blob hitting a weekly reset button, I mean, think about oncology. Think about regenerative medicine.
Oh, absolutely.
If we can understand how a complex animal perfectly controls its own cellular growth, halts it, and systemically recycles its own tissues without causing rampant inflammation or cancer, I mean, that is the holy grail.
It really is the holy grail of biology right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why researchers from Washington to Israel are spending decades trying to study this creature. But getting it into the lab, presents a massive roadblock, doesn't it?
It does. It's what we call the Petri dish problem.
The Petri dish problem.
Yeah, to do deep, mechanistic molecular biology, you cannot just rely on whole living animals all the time. You need an immortal cell line.
Right, because you need a controlled environment.
Exactly. Immortal cell lines are isolated cells that you can grow indefinitely in a lab environment. Right now, there are thousands of immortal cell lines for mammals, for fish, even for some insects.
Okay.
But for tunicates, practically zero.
Wait, really? Zero?
Practically zero, yeah. When researchers extract primary epithelial cells from the tunicate and put them in a culture medium, the cells just stop dividing after 24 to 72 hours.
Oh, wow. So it's less like they are retiring and more like they have an engine with a built-in kill switch.
That's a great way to put it.
I mean, in a mammalian cell, you can sometimes bypass that natural limit.
Yeah, I can, yeah.
But the tunicate cells seem to have this kill switch hardwired so deeply that the moment they're removed from the colony's shared blood supply and that matrix, the engine just locks up.
It completely locks up.
So if you want them to keep dividing so you can study them, you have to find a way to break that kill switch.
Which brings us to the core of the researcher's strategy to create this cell line. It's a concept called stress-induced evolution.
Stress-induced evolution. Okay, how does that work?
Well, in mammalian cell cultures, when scientists face a stubborn cell that refuses to immortalize, they sometimes expose it to a weak genotoxin.
A poison, basically.
Exactly. A common choice is nickel, which is a heavy metal.
Right.
The nickel creates immense oxidative stress inside the cell. It essentially interferes with the cell's ability to clear out reactive oxygen species.
Wait, reactive oxygen species, those are basically unstable molecules that act like microscopic rust, right?
Yeah, that's exactly what they are.
Like, they fly around inside the cell just tearing apart proteins and DNA.
That is a perfect way to visualize it. This cellular rust leads to widespread damage. It essentially forces mutations.
Okay.
Both genetic mutations, meaning changes to the actual DNA code, and epigenetic mutations, meaning changes to how the DNA is read and expressed.
I see.
So the logic of stress-induced evolution is that under this extreme life-or-death pressure, the genomic instability might accidentally create a specific mutation that disables that biological kill switch.
Ah, so it allows the cells to bypass their natural limits and divide forever.
Yes. It's essentially a cellular lottery.
Wow.
The researcher's goal was to try this nickel gamble on the tunicate's primary epithelial cells to finally establish a continuous immortal cell line.
Okay, so let me get this straight. Before we strip these cells out of their comfortable colony, throw them naked into a petri dish and poison them with heavy metals, don't we need a baseline?
What do you mean?
I mean, a whole colony has a shared blood supply and complex organs to help manage stress. Don't we need to know how the whole organism handles nickel before we can understand what its isolated cells are doing?
Yes. And that is the exact logical progression the researcher followed.
Okay, good.
She went out to the city of Des Moines Marina, collected wild tunicate colonies growing on the sides of the floating docks, brought them back to the lab, and conducted whole organism toxicity tests.
Just to see what they could handle.
Right. She placed them in artificial seawater, spiked with increasing concentrations of nickel chloride, expecting to find the lethal dose fairly quickly.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. The tunicate proved to be practically invincible.
Invincible is almost an understatement.
Let's put some numbers to this, because the sheer scale of the toxicity they survived is hard to wrap your head around.
It really is.
Normal coastal surface waters might have, what, a fraction of a single microgram of nickel per liter?
Yeah, very, very small amounts.
Even in a heavily polluted marina, you might see one or two micrograms.
Right. So in ecotoxicology, researchers look for the LC50. That's the lethal concentration required to kill 50% of the population.
Okay.
At 24 hours, the crude LC50 for this tunicate was an astonishing 177 milligrams per liter.
Milligrams, not micrograms.
Milligrams. We're talking about surviving doses that place them among the most nickel-tolerant marine invertebrates ever recorded.
That is insane.
But the true breakthrough didn't come from finding the lethal dose. It came from observing how they behaved at a highly toxic but sublethal dose of 100 milligrams per liter.
Okay, so what happened at 100 milligrams?
Well, at that concentration, the colonies didn't die. Instead, they exhibited what the researcher identified as blastogenic arrest.
The pause button.
Exactly. A pause button that comes with a physical lockdown. The colonies physically shrank their gripping appendages, which are called ampullae.
Okay.
They halted the flow of hemolymph through their vascular network. And most importantly, they completely stopped their weekly rebirth cycle.
They just stopped blastogenesis entirely.
Completely. The primary buds halted their growth. The adult zooids refused to be broken down and reabsorbed. Everything simply froze in place.
Wait, I have to challenge this strategy.
Go for it.
When a human body, or almost any typical animal model, faces a severe toxin, it fights back.
Right? Gradually, yes.
It's an active molecular war. We flood our system with massive amounts of antioxidants. We ramp up DNA repair mechanisms to desperately fix the damage. Are you telling me the tunicate's primary survival response is to just stop time and do nothing?
This raises an important question, and that apparent lack of a fight is exactly why the researcher performed RNA sequencing on the entire colony.
To see what was happening genetically.
Exactly. She needed to see precisely which genes were turning on and off during this extreme nickel exposure. And the genetic data confirmed your suspicion about how weird this is.
Really?
Yeah. In a standard animal model, you would expect to see primary antioxidant enzymes, like SOD1, absolutely skyrocketing to clear out that cellular rust we talked about earlier.
Right, the rust cleanup crew.
But in the tunicate, SOD1 barely spiked, even at the highest toxic doses.
Wow.
And canonical DNA repair genes didn't go into overdrive either.
So what did change? If they aren't fighting the rust, what pathways are they activating?
The transcription pathways that saw the most significant alteration were developmental ones, specifically the TGF-beta pathway.
TGF-beta, what does that do?
TGF-beta acts as a master traffic cop in the body. It controls cellular differentiation, tissue growth, and apoptosis. It regulates when cells divide and when they stop.
Oh, I see.
So the tunicate wasn't fighting a classical molecular war against the nickel. Its survival strategy was to fundamentally alter its developmental signaling to hit pause on generational turnover.
It used the traffic cop to stop all the traffic.
Exactly. It used TGF-beta to tell every cell in the colony to just hold its position.
You know, that is actually a brilliant metabolic energy-saving strategy.
It really is when you think about it.
Because if blastogenesis, that weekly cycle of aggressively breaking down adult bodies and rapidly growing new ones, if that naturally produces a massive amount of internal oxidative stress.
Which it does.
Doing that while being bathed in toxic nickel from the outside would be an absolute death sentence.
Exactly. It would be way too much stress at once.
Right. So by pausing generation turnover, the tunicate minimizes its internal stress, reserving all of its baseline metabolic energy to simply outlast the external nickel shock.
It is an incredibly elegant systemic preservation strategy. But remember, the ultimate goal of the thesis wasn't just to observe whole colonies.
Right.
It was to create an immortal cell line in a petri dish.
Yes, which brings us back to the isolated cells. Because if the whole colony survives by hitting pause using its shared systemic signaling, what happens when you strip all that away?
That is the million-dollar question.
If you take a few isolated epithelial cells, put them alone in a plastic dish, and blast them with that same extreme dose of nickel, do they still know how to hit pause, or do they just die?
This is where the in vitro experiment gets highly technical and very, very clever.
Okay, tell me.
In the past, researchers usually just let the extracted tissue float in the liquid media and hoped it would attach to the bottom of the dish so the cells could grow.
Sounds a bit unscientific, just hoping.
Yeah, a bit of trial and error.
Yeah.
But this researcher used tissue from stage D primary buds and zooids and employed a technique called partial desiccation.
Partial desiccation, so drying them out.
Essentially, yes. She placed the tissue in the dish and slightly dried it out for 10 minutes before adding the liquid media back in.
Why does drying them out make them stick to the plastic?
Well, by evaporating the surrounding water just slightly, she essentially created a localized surface tension trap.
Oh, interesting.
It forced the cellular membranes into direct physical contact with the plastic substrate before they had a chance to float away.
And did it work?
It resulted in nearly 100% adherence.
Wow.
Yeah, she created beautiful, perfectly adhered single layers of epithelial cells.
Okay, so the cells are locked onto the dish. Now comes the gamble. She hits them with the genotoxic nickel to try and force that immortalizing mutation.
Right. She doses these delicate monolayers with the heavy nickel concentration. She waits 24 hours, places the dish under the phase contrast microscope, and the cells are visibly unfazed.
They haven't phased.
Completely. They retain their flat, cuboidal shape. They maintain their tight intercellular junctions, holding hands with their neighboring cells.
No way.
Yeah, they didn't detach and float away, which is, you know, the universal telltale sign of a dying cell in culture.
They just tanked the hit.
They absorbed it completely.
Mm.
So the next logical step was to see what was happening inside.
To see if the mutation happened.
Right, to see if the nickel was actually forcing those genetic and epigenetic mutations needed for stress-induced evolution.
Mm.
So she attempted to extract their RNA.
Okay.
But to do that, you have to break open the cells. And this is where she hit a literal biological wall. The RNA extraction completely failed.
Oh, no. Let me guess. The cells were too tough for the basic chemicals, so she had to use physical force. And she ended up pulverizing them so badly that the RNA was too degraded to use.
Honestly, that is exactly what you would expect to happen.
Yeah.
But that's not what occurred. She tried every extreme measure in the modern biological toolkit. First, she flooded the dish with Kragan chemical lysis buffers.
Which are what, exactly?
They are these harsh detergents specifically designed to completely dissolve the fats and proteins that make up an animal cell membrane.
Oh, so they basically melt the cell.
Exactly. But when that didn't work, she used mechanical cell scrapers.
Just physically scraping them.
Yeah. Then she tried syringe needle shearing, which means literally trying to rip the cells apart by forcing them through the microscopic opening of a tiny needle.
Yikes!
And finally, she resorted to bead beating.
Oh, wow. For those who haven't worked in a lab, bead beating is brutal. You are essentially throwing microscopic silica or zirconia beads at the cells and shaking them at thousands of revolutions per minute to physically smash them open.
It is maximum physical destruction.
Yeah.
Yet, after all of that, she put the dish back under the microscope. And the cells remained perfectly intact.
Are you serious?
Dead serious.
Oh.
They were floating around in the harsh lysis detergents, completely unbothered. They survived the chemical bath, the needles, and the microscopic bead bombardment.
Wait. How is a single layer of cells surviving mechanical shearing and chemical lysis? That doesn't make any sense.
It really defies logic, doesn't it?
I mean, an animal cell membrane is basically just a fragile lipid bilayer. It's a delicate bubble of fat. How does a microscopic bubble of fat tank that kind of physical destruction?
It survives because of what the cells built the moment they felt stressed.
Built? What did they build?
Well, when observing the cultures closely, she noticed a fibrous, invigable substance forming around the tissue explants and the epithelial sheets. The cells had actively secreted a tunic-like substance directly into the petri dish, encasing themselves.
Oh my God.
Now remember the broader evolutionary context of what makes tunicates totally unique in the entire animal kingdom.
Oh, the cellulose. They are the only animals on Earth that naturally produce cellulose.
Precisely. Cellulose is a complex carbohydrate. It is rigid, impenetrable, and it is the exact same material that makes up plant cell walls.
It's what makes wood hard.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So the tunicate cells hadn't just sat there naked in the dish. They had built an invisible microscopic plant armor around themselves to survive the stress of isolation and the heavy metal toxicity.
I need to pause here because the evolutionary biology of this is just staggering. How does an animal produce plant fiber? Animals don't have the genes for that.
They didn't originally.
Huh.
Millions of years ago, an ancient ancestor of the tunicate absorbed a cellulose-producing bacterium.
Okay.
Through an incredibly rare event called horizontal gene transfer, the bacterial gene for making cellulose was accidentally integrated directly into the animal's DNA.
Just copied and pasted into their own code.
Exactly. Became a permanent part of their genome. So today, when these isolated animal cells sense a lethal environment, they don't panic. They just switch on their ancient stolen genes and build a botanical fortress.
So this totally explains the extraction failure.
Yes.
The researcher is using chemical buffers and needles designed to pop delicate animal fat bubbles. But the cells are hiding behind a reinforced wall of plant fiber.
Yep.
You can't dissolve wood with a lipid detergent.
You really can't.
So what does this all mean? To study this animal's genetics moving forward, she is literally going to have to use an enzyme meant for digesting plants like cellulose just to break through the biological shields these cells deploy?
Exactly. It completely flips the script on how we handle these experiments.
Yeah.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this research changes how we have to approach ecotoxicology and cellular biology in non-model organisms.
Because they don't play by the normal rules.
Right. The tunicate survives extreme, unnatural toxicity, not by fighting a classical molecular war with antioxidants, but by modulating its developmental timing, pausing its own life cycle, and relying on this impenetrable plant-like armor.
It's amazing.
It proves that when we study extreme survival biology, we have to throw out our standard mammalian-centric playbooks. We can't just assume every animal reacts to stress by ramping up DNA repair and fighting the rest.
Sometimes they just build a wall and wait for the danger to pass.
Exactly.
It is deeply humbling to realize how incredibly resourceful life is. We started this deep dive talking about the expectation of precision in biology, how we want things to be clean, binary, and follow the rules we've written.
But biology is rarely clean.
No, it's really not. But this squishy, dock-dwelling tunicate shows us that survival isn't always about aggressively fighting back. Sometimes survival is about knowing exactly when to stop entirely.
That's a great takeaway.
And it leaves me with a thought that I cannot shake. If a simple marine blob clinging to a piece of plastic in a polluted marina has evolved the ability to literally hit a biological pause button on its own aging and build an invisible suit of plant armor to survive a toxic shock, what dormant, unrecognized survival mechanisms might be hiding deep within our own human DNA? After all, we share that deep evolutionary ancestor. What ancient, incredibly weird biological fail-safes might be waiting inside us, just waiting for the right extreme trigger to finally wake them up?
Now that is a fascinating question to ponder, and one that reminds us how much of our own biology remains an uncharted frontier.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the rulebook, and we'll see you next time.